All right, Chapter 8, Earthward Bound. Our trip to Retz was faster this time because we had been summoned by the master. My uncle and I stepped into the bubble car and seated ourselves. Within moments, we appeared just outside the gates of Retz. Briskly, we walked to the Temple of Golden Wisdom and, bearing our gifts, entered to meet the master, Kajuri. Kajuri was an older, beardless man with remarkably white, almost silver-white long, flowing hair. As he stood before us, I sensed how ancient and yet how young Kajuri was. It is a paradox I cannot explain. His deep green, flashing eyes spoke of endless wisdom and compassion. Like any true master, Kajuri was a beautiful soul surrounded by an air of serene silence. We presented our gifts, a plant for the temple and fruit for the master. Together we seated ourselves on cushions and chanted aloud the word Amural, Titanian word, for love. The room suddenly glowed with a warm pink light, and Kajuri began to speak. "I've called you here for Omnic to be able to make a choice," he said. Omnic Onic is my Venusian name, using English letters to spell the Venusian sounds. The name means spiritual rebound. Kajuri went on to say that a little girl was living on Earth with whom I had formerly shared a past life during the time of the French Revolution. We were sisters during those turbulent years, very close to each other. I had been involved in acts of treason and my life was in danger when my sister stepped forward to take the blame. Out of her love for me, and because she felt it important that I continue my work, she was beheaded in my place. Kajuri explained that she was now a little girl living in the United States and suffering a great deal within her family. Her mother was taking care of her as best as she could, but both she and her husband were caught up in drinking and fighting. At the age of 7, this little girl, Sheila, was to be sent to her grandmother's in Chattanooga, Tennessee, as a protection from the trouble and fighting at home. Now looking into the future, the master had seen Sheila being killed in a bus accident en route on the outskirts of Little Rock, Arkansas. Since I was an older soul and at this time had less ties on Venus, I had a special choice. I could lower my vibrations into the physical and go to Earth to balance out my karma in this lifetime. After the accident had occurred, her body could be taken care of and I could go on in her place. Then I would live in her family as Sheila instead of Omnic Onic, and in doing this, work off some of my own karma and hers, therefore balancing cause and effect relations in a number of different ways. Instead of being reborn on Earth, I was being offered the unusual opportunity of having my Venusian body densified to the Earth physical plane. I would retain my consciousness, awareness, and memory as a strong background to help me through the trials I would face. My karma would be difficult for me to understand or cope with if I were just born on Earth without knowing the truth of the higher planes. By going to Earth now, the master explained the conditions were such that I could work off my karma with less anguish and may never have to come into the physical plane of Earth again. In addition, I was destined to spiritual work on Earth and a plan. It had to do with the openings of people's minds about the Brotherhood of Planets. The details would be revealed during my life on Earth. This was a great shock to me, and of course frightening. I had not realized that I would be leaving so soon, and I had never heard of any of our people leaving as children. Adults who have physical karma often do lower their vibrations to leave the astral and live on Earth. This had been mentioned by masters during the seminars in Retz. At the same time, I was all very excited. I did not know much about Earth in this lifetime. I had only heard about it as many people in America hear about Asia or some remote part of the world. The suffering other people go through does not reach you and does not mean as much as it should if you are removed from it. Being a child and filled with the spirit of adventure, I felt that my living on Earth would be exciting. So I said to Kanjuri that I would make up my mind and let him know. Kanjuri assured me that if I decide to leave Venus, I would be given all the necessary knowledge and all the preparations would be made. I would learn about the girl's family and be taught the American English, the language they used. And before I left, I would be briefed on the people of Earth, their consciousness, their culture and technology, especially what I could expect and experience in the southern United States. On strategic occasions, I was promised the help, the mental guidance of many people through Odin and someone close to me. With that final word of encouragement, Kanjuri concluded, added that I had several days to consider the prospect. Without hesitation, I said that my decision had already been made. I would leave Venus to spend the rest of my days on planet Earth. Kanjuri remained silent for a moment as my aunt began to speak. She reminded me that I was not compelled to go if I did not feel that it was right. I understood that, I told her, but I felt the decision was one of karma and that I was destined to leave Venus rather than having a choice about it. I understood that in the physical world, I was to be a child of 7 years. My astral body, when I would leave Venus, would look like a 7-year-old girl, and yet my consciousness upon becoming physical would be more advanced because I had been born on the astral plane and inherited the culture and teachings of Venus. My first inner vision of Sheila was very revealing. I favored her a great deal, partly because of our karmic ties. Physically, we look very much alike, which gave me all the more reason to believe it was all planned, that it was karma. I accepted this as my karma, and I had a strong desire to work it off and be finished with these obligations. I also felt it was necessary for Sheila to be released from the physical world. She had suffered enough. My decision to leave was more of an intuition than anything else, and the inner prompting I felt makes me realize now that my choice to come to Earth was itself karmatically determined. Kanjuri repeated his promise that the training program would begin. Someone would call on me within a few days. We thanked the master, and he told me I had made a very wise decision. In my life on Earth, I might not find the spiritual teachings of Venus until much later, and I was not to talk about these teachings because people would not understand. When the time was right, they would openly reveal in America, but I was not to seek them. They would come to me, and I will find a surprise with these teachings. With a smile, the master fell silent. We said goodbye and left. At home, I wanted to be by myself, thinking about the consequences of my decision. I reconsidered more than once, yet I felt more strongly that it wasn't mine to be made, that it was destiny. I was thinking about my upcoming journey as a child in a childish way, as being an adventure with many unknowns. True to Conjura's word, several days later, a master appeared at our door, a very unusual person for people on Venus. With his dark brown eyes and long black hair falling to his shoulders, he was striking in our society where most people are blonde. Vonick was his name. He said that he had come to teach me about Sheila, her family, about English, and how people's attitudes differed on Earth. We sat down for the first of many long conversations. Vonick had been chosen as my teacher because of his patience. Throughout my life and many lifetimes, I was known to be impulsive, to just jump into things abruptly without thinking. I was given to interpretations with completely unrelated thoughts that just happened to pop into my mind. This discouraged a lot of people, but not Vonick, who was very nice about it. He was very quiet, only told me the facts, listened to what I had to say, and did not give any point of view or criticism. In those next few weeks, Vonick covered just about everything I needed to know. Never before had I done so much memorizing at once, but it was necessary for me to learn quickly. Fortunately, I was gifted with a good memory and was not encumbered with a physical mind. Vonick briefed me on Sheila's personal history and her family's, so that I would be familiar with her personalities and their way of life. I learned as much about Sheila's grandmother and mother as a 7-year-old child would be expected to know. I needed to learn the description of each relative so that I would be able to recognize them and speak with them in the right way when I met them. Vonick also familiarized me with the Southern people's customs and consciousness. We went into some detail on living conditions as well, the kind of poverty I would be exposed to. In the physical world, Vonick said, people are often deprived of basic physical needs, unlike the astral plane, where our thoughts instantly create whatever we desire. All of this training took a great deal of time, day after day of getting together, going over these facts, and me pretending I was Sheila. Vonick and I worked wherever the mood of the occasion took us, around the sunken fireplace in my room, upstairs, in the garden, or in the golden beach. I practiced talking and acting like Sheila, and Vonick would ask questions about her family that I had to answer properly. It was very important. He said to think of myself as being Sheila rather than just acting the part. This went on until I learned about my mother's childhood, her real father, the marriage situations that produced all her cousins, and the kind of person her stepfather was. I memorized the illnesses Sheila had had, the many places she had lived, and the hardship she was going through up to the time of the bus accident. Most of Sheila's own experiences, what her mother had told her, and what she had learned on her own, were covered in my talks with Vonick. I never asked Vonick how he learned all of the very personal information about Sheila's family, but I'm sure that one of our people living on Earth had become friends with them. Vonick made a special point of mentioning what would be expected of me and what I could not do, such as using the psychic and spiritual powers I had developed. People generally would not understand, and they might become frightened enough to accuse me of Satanism or black magic. I was certainly not to tell anyone of my true origin until the time was right, which would not be until I was older. Vonnegut taught me about the different religions of Earth, how most of them were merely social gatherings instead of true spiritual teachings. I learned about the many different concepts of God and the concept of the negative power as a mystical being called Satan. I was not to expect the freedom allowed in Venusian society or be very disappointed by limitations in every area of my life. The schools I would be attending, Vonnegut explained, would not be as advanced in their teachings, method, or in what they taught. So I had to be careful not to show that I knew so much. I was to pretend that I was learning and not be discouraged. The educators on Earth, Vonnegut said, did the best according to what they knew and according to the limitations of the conditions on Earth. I had to remember that there was no turning back since I had arrived. It would cause a great deal of trouble for everyone. I would not be paying my karmic debt, and I would be creating more karma on top of that. In times of great anguish, I was not to try escaping by saying, "I'm really not Sheila, and I won't put up with this." I was paying back a debt that Sheila had suffered for me long ago, and I was suffering for her in return. Often I was reminded that by Vonnegut, that there were many hardships ahead, but he never went into great detail. The only promise made to me was that they would keep in mental contact with me, but that they could not change any of the future events. As I look back now, I realize that Vonnegut did a thorough job of preparing me for life on Earth. That is, I had more than enough knowledge to comfortably become a part of an Earth family. Vonnegut and I became very good friends. During my training period, the anniversary of my birth arrived. Unknown to me, Arena and Odin had made a plan for a special experience for me, to journey into other levels of the astral plane. They had mentioned only that there would be a party to celebrate my birth. In the morning on that special day, my aunt and I visited friends who lived not far from our house. When we came home, Rimja and all of my best friends, as well as Vonnegut and my uncle, were waiting to help celebrate my birthday. All of the rooms were decorated with flowers and butterflies and things of nature I most loved to draw. There were paintings and wall hangings, murals and cutouts, even mobiles and butterflies. Zamura presented me with a dress having a print of a butterfly to go along with the theme of my party. After dinner, we sang songs and danced and played music and games, but the best was yet to come. Aunt Arena took me aside to spring the great news. That evening, our family and friends would go on a journey through the astral plane. In order for us to keep the same level of consciousness and somebody not get misplaced or hung up somewhere, we would all be under the supervision of the pilot, Uncle Odin. A joyous feeling of anticipation filled the air as we climbed aboard the bubble car. I knew that one of the most memorable experiences of my life was ahead. It would be my first adventure beyond the surface of Venus and my first journey through the vast world, which is known to many of Earth's people as heaven. As our ship took off and the city of Titonia became smaller and smaller below us, I saw the first of many breathtaking spectacles. Titonia is shaped much like a giant angelic star, with one longer tapering point reaching between the two mountains toward the sea. All around us, as we left Venus, swirled beautiful color forms of unmanifested thoughts and emotions. Some were like fireworks, magnificent shooting colors never seen in the physical world. These were the regions of the astral that had not yet been manifested or created into form. Delightful seas of heavenly energy. All of outer space looks like this on the astral plane. Our first destination was the lower astral plane, the land of nightmares and ugly passions. I did not mean to say that the astral plane had a number of layers, though, through which we traveled up and down. We call the various regions lower, middle, and higher to indicate the inhabitants' level of consciousness awareness, which reflect in the body forms, colors, landscapes, and overall feeling of the area. A feeling of fearlessness overcame me as we entered the lower astral plane. It was an eerie region with distorted landscapes, twisted trees, giant spider webs, smoking forests, and grotesque creatures. If you can imagine what a haunted forest would look like, then you are probably picking up mentally what already exists somewhere on the lower astral plane. The souls who live here are so attached to the passions, anger, greed, lust, that they take horrible-looking subhuman forms. Some of them are intriguing to see, but most are as frightening as the dark, murky colors surrounding them. Here, too, are homes and communities, but instead of devoting themselves to creativity and the arts, these people spend their days indulging in their favorite passions. A glutton could be seen day in and day out surrounding himself with tasty foods to delight his senses and spending little time away from the dining table. Likewise, a miser would manifest jewels and gold and precious things until his home left little room for him to live. The lower astral is where evil souls spend time between physical lives temporarily until they become somewhat detached from their passions. Many of the Orthodox religions have in fact created hell regions on the lower astral plane for themselves, which unfortunately have become traps for souls who believe their stay there is eternal. Hell is as real as the people who want it believe it is. Returning to the middle astral, we flew over many very beautiful civilized areas where different religious groups had established their heavenly communities. The people here lived in peace, learning creative talents as we did at our level on Venus, and being very much aware of their return someday to the physical worlds. Many of them had created the homes and surroundings of their physical planet. The landscapes and villages we now saw were much more radiant and colorful than their physical counterparts on Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Earth, and other planets. There seemed to be an endless variety of landscapes, painted mountains, craggy mountains, soft rolling hills, valleys, meadows, lakes, deserts, and forests. At our level on Venus, nature was a luminous festival of color. The sights were truly heavenly. As we continued on, my uncle explained as best he could whatever attracted my attention. The higher astral is a much more spiritual region where more highly evolved souls live. Anyone who had experienced it will agree that it is not easy to describe in physical terms, as the colors were more redefined and spiraling, and there was a greater feeling of peace, joy, serenity, and the spiritual high. Within Shahashra Del Kanwal, the capital of this place, was one of the most beautiful regions I had ever seen. It was called Zurf. I can understand why so many religions have their heavenly abodes here. The flowing gardens of Zurf cannot be described in words. They exist for the inhabitants to enjoy. When people arrive here after their physical demise, they believe this is the highest achievement in the afterlife, yet it is only the first step on a long and arduous journey. We did not have time to stop here or to explore many of the intriguing regions of the astral. Such a tour could very well last several lifetimes in Earth standards of time. One of the most spectacular sights was below us, as Odin told of the Surs race, ancestors of the inhabitants of Shahashra Del Kanwal. Near the center of this heavenly white city stands a colossal statue, so huge that our bubble car seemed like a speck in the sky next to it. Seeing it from the air is a breathtaking sight. Looking up from the ground, a person would strain his eyes to see the top. This giant statue represents the Surus race, which my uncle explained were the space people who first colonized planets of this physical plane. Among the giants who settled in what became Atlantis were members of the Surus race. I was hypnotized not only by its beauty, but also by its dimensions. The feet of this colossal statue stand far enough apart that on foot it would take days to walk around it. Since the city is as big as Earth's continents, many of its attractions are very spectacular in their sheer size. The luminous white wall, easily as high as the tallest skyscraper on Earth, surrounds the city. In the very center stands the majestic mountain of light, powerhouse of this plane. Out of the peak of the mountain of light stream thousands of colorful lights, and each of these is made of smaller lights. Each light is alive. It was an utterly breathtaking sight. The sound of the roaring sea filled the air. The lights flowed into the sky and onward to support the physical plane and its many forms of life. The mountain of light is higher than any of the physical universe. As our ships passed directly over it, I had to shut my eyes for a moment. Even for the astral eyes, the light was so intense as to be painful. Odin explained that this was a very important city to the people of the more advanced planets. It is a crossover city between the astral and the physical planes, and would be very important for me in the future. Here is a place which enables an astral being to manifest a physical body. The people here were beautiful, with faces that spoke so much wisdom. With their flowing tunics and sandals, they resemble the ancient Greeks of Earth mythology. Among the inhabitants of the city were a stately co-workers of the Creator, which we call angels. Like our culture on Venus, every moment of life was spent in creative expression. My uncle stopped the ship for a last look around and my last chance to soak up the beauty, which I had never forgotten. How can one forget a city that is pure white and glowing, with tints of blue here and there, and structures so spectacular, you are speechless. A number of the villages we flew over were enveloped in indescribable melodies, the sound of each village itself. Zurif was like this also. The music seemed like the tunes of a xylophone and harp, and occasionally violins. All through the astral plane was a feeling of spiritual high, of wisdom, of peace and beauty. Imagine worlds where the people live completely confident and at ease with themselves, not seeing each other with eyes of anger and vanity, jealousy and envy. They see each other as soul, each equally beautiful and confident as sparks of deity. I suppose this is why it hurts me at times to look back at my past. It is not easy to talk about my life on Venus because I have a taste of paradise, and then live here is very painful. And yet I know the kind of life that awaits me when this short life comes to an end. All the sufferings in the many lives on Earth will seem like a bad dream. We took a faster route home. All of us were tired. We were not fatigued in any physical sense, but congested with so many beautiful memories. At home, I lay back and closed my eyes, letting it all soak deep down into my mind, so when a time comes that I am feeling low, I can pull these memories out again. Having seen the wonders of the astral plane, I began to anticipate my trip to Earth more and more. I thought of it, too, as an adventure, but at times it seemed very frightening. I had been told that parts of Earth were much like the lower astral plane. I thought how wonderful it was that I could go to Earth prepared in this way, prepared to take on whatever karma I had accumulated, to be able to understand how everything had happened was part of my lessons and experiences, to not get caught up in them and let them overpower me, to realize that there is something greater than the restricted physical life, because I had consciously seen it and experienced it in my own lifetime. To know that these beautiful worlds exist for all and not just for a few, and that someday I would live to tell this story to others and give them hope. Next morning, I thanked my aunt and uncle for one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. I would be leaving it in about 2 days and once again see that great white city with the towering walls, only this time we would lower our vibrations and appear on the physical Venus. From Aunt Irina, I received permission to take along the ring and a gift of jewelry. My uncle gave to me was the physical level of Venus and would be given later. Jewelry I could easily hide or explain away, but not something as unusual as the Venusian dress or sandals or anything reflecting our culture. In not taking along unusual things, I would not need to become untruthful to protect myself. I had to be careful to be truthful, they told me, because if I was known as an untruthful child, then my story later would not be taken for real. Most of my preparation for leaving was an inner preparation of getting my thoughts in order. My aunt helped by giving pep talks once in a while. She loved me very much and was sad to see me go. She said if I wished to change my mind, I could. Again, I was reminded of the bitter times ahead and how I would need strength to hold up and not think I had been abandoned. They could not interfere in my own karma, however, no matter how much it hurt them to see me suffer. They would watch at all times via the inner sense and send advice. Then, when the right time came, the laws of the Supreme Deity would be taught openly on Earth. I would meet someone that I knew, and I might have an opportunity to tell my story to the world. Until then, I would have to be secretive because of the nature of Earth's people's attitudes. They explained that these attitudes were based on the limited surroundings or environment and the practice of teaching children to be duplicates of their adults rather than individuals. I would fall into a lot of traps and be taken to different religious paths, but I was not to become too involved. I remember well my last day on Venus. In the morning, my aunt brought to my room the dress I would be wearing on Earth, the same dress little Sheila would be wearing on the day of the bus accident. Arena had manifested for me, keeping in mind the directions the Master had given her. I put it on and tucked it away, a duplicate of the note of explanation Sheila's mother had written and Sheila would be taking along to her grandmother in Tennessee. I also wore white socks and black patent leather shoes with buckles. These were very strange. I had never before had my foot completely enclosed. As I remember, Aunt Arena asked if I wanted to join her to tell my friends that I would be leaving shortly. I would rather stay behind and be alone for a while, I told her. She nodded and left. I stood in the arched doorway watching her graceful body as she walked away down the softly sloping front path. Going off to the left and right were many little footpaths of stone winding among the flowering bushes and trees. Two blue trees with blue trunk and leaves formed the front gate. They resembled earth pines. Turning around, I found myself facing another shoulder-high wrought metal fence looking so much like white lacy walls. I plucked one of the white flowers and sniffed it, enjoying its sweet smell, and the shining green leaves. I walked toward the center of our living room, toward the fireplace where we had so often shared our experiences together during study time. It was a huge room. Here and there were floating sofas of various sorts of colors. I looked at the crystal clear walls curving up toward the ceiling. I had always taken for granted the beauty of these walls being transparent, showing us the colorful surroundings and the garden. I stopped in front of my favorite painting, a very large painting hanging on the wall by no visible means of support. It was made of constantly swirling colors, each color having its own sound, and each sound changing as the colors did. As they swirled around, I never grew tired of watching and listening to this painting. It was never inharmonious in any way, always creating a new, intriguing melody. Such works of art were popular on Venus. As I listened to the sweet music in our indoor waterfall, I envisioned my father's face, as I had done so many times throughout my childhood. I remembered his face as I had seen it shortly after I was born, his beautiful face, which I stamped into my memory, knowing inwardly I would never see him again. I always did this when I closed my eyes, burning his image deeper into my mind as if it would bring him back to me. I remember now his broad, square jaw, high cheekbones, and very intense, almost navy blue eyes with whitish, blonde, arched brows. Father's nose was long and straight with flared nostrils. His wide, full-lipped mouth was a deep red, and his golden, blonde hair parted on the side and combed to the left rather than being parted in the middle as most men wore their hair. It was shoulder length and fell gently in a wave at his left eye. I remembered his smile, so gentle and sweet. On the day I was born, I saw in his brief gaze the love he had had for me. Yes, I remembered well my father's face, the deep cleft of his chin, and the dimple when he smiled. I opened my eyes slowly, got up. I walked around the fireplace and past the couch, feeling its softness with my fingers as I passed by. At the waterfall, I sat down on a tiny retaining wall surrounding the pool. The top was inlaid with small tiles of mother of pearl, broidered in gold. Several golden blue various colored fish flitted around in the water. As I held my fingers out to catch some of the falling water, I noted that it changed the tunes in the waterfall that the waterfall made. I closed my eyes to listen. It always sounded like a harp with water pouring through it, if you could imagine such a sound. At this time, I had felt something welling up inside, some emotion I was unused to, some strange feeling that I had almost felt the day I thought I was being punished. I did not know what this feeling was. This sadness was beginning to choke me. I looked to the left and saw my aunt's great circular herb garden with its hundreds of different interesting herbs. She had explained them all once to me, all of their medicinal uses and their mystical folklore surrounding them through the centuries. As I stood there, I relived these moments with her. Ahead at a distance, I saw the beautiful fan tree that I had loved so much that I pretended to be a bird in and climbed and played under. This beautiful tree with its trunk spreading out and vines hanging down, making it look very much like an oriental fan. I listened to the birds singing and I glanced at my swing, swaying in the breeze in midair. Its lacy design made in interesting shadows on the grassy ground. I walked over and flung myself face down in the swing to watch the little insects crawling around, insects that I myself had created. There really are not any pests or insects on the astral plane, except those which the people manifest. Some of them, I thought, were cute, and whenever I had enough information, I would manifest them for our garden. I glanced up at the pinkish orange sky and its colorful clouds. Then I took the footpath back to the house and stood in the doorway, facing the garden once again and shutting my eyes. I tried to burn it into my memory forever. I turned and walked slowly back into the house, stopping at the door to my room. Going in, I sat on my bed on the covers that looked like flowers and leaves woven together. My baby coverlet, the one that my aunt made with the animals that changed color, I had made into a pillow. It was one of the many colorful pillows, most of which I had designed and created. As I sat on my bed, I looked around at this familiar place, up at the ceiling, at the golden ropes encircled by flowers, at the tree with its delicate swing, at the wall of vines and flowers. I walked over to the sunken tub I had made from seashells and starfish and ran some water out of the golden fish spigots. There I sat sloshing my feet for a few moments. Then I looked over at the little wooden table that my uncle had carved and colored to look like a tiny tree. I remembered how much I loved it from the moment he gave it to me. As I glanced around my room that I created, that I felt was as much a part of me as my soul, akin to my soul. I could feel a warm liquid running from my eyes down my cheeks. This emotional feeling that I had never experienced before was welling up inside me. I was crying for the first time in my life since the day of my birth. I realized that this pent-up feeling was being released as the tears fell. There was a great feeling of satisfaction of releasing myself of these emotions. I sat quietly and sobbed, watching the tears as they ran down my face and dripped onto my hands. I got up, splashed some water on my face, looked again around my room, and sighed deeply. I'll never forget this, I said to myself. I followed this curved divider back into the living room. The last place for me to see was the dining room above. Slowly, I went up the carved marble jade stair, watching as I went up, seeing the gently arched oriental bridges here and there around the railed balcony. I walked to the dining area and sat down at my favorite carved oak table in the very center. I manifested a cup of herb tea, and as I was sitting, sipping the tea and thinking of how much I loved this place and my aunt and uncle, I heard Aunt Irina call. The moment she saw my face as I came down the stair, she realized there had been a change. I went up to her and embraced her. We held each other, sobbing quietly. Irina must have been experiencing tears for the first time, too. We stood there in silence. She pushed me back at arm's length and looked into my eyes. I said, "Aunt, you've taught me so much of the beauty of life. You made me understand that my father really loved me. You've taken care of me, and I'm sure that you are better to me than you would have been to your own child. I have learned from you a great deal of compassion. You have given me emotional stability, which will carry me through my hardships on earth, as you have explained will come to me there. Through you, I have learned to look at things and see beauty and quality, and to pity those who are not as fortunate as I in their awareness and station in life. I've yet to experience this fully, and know that I will need a great deal more compassion for others. But through your loving face, which I will hold in my memory forever, and through your beautiful hands and your words, I have learned a great deal more than most people I know. I am thankful for all of this, Aunt Irina, and I will never forget you. You've given me life, and for this I know my mother is eternally grateful." Just then Uncle Odin walked up. I went to him and I hugged him strongly, saying, "I hope you heard everything I said." He nodded. "That goes for you too," I said, "because without you I would not have learned to laugh when things go wrong. I would not have learned my sense of humor. I learned from you to press things on instead of getting upset, to shrug sadness off, to reap joy out of the small things in life, to be unaffected by what others would call disaster. Yes, I have learned much through you, Uncle. Strength, how to keep going when life does not work out right. I've learned to make things useful and to not waste time. I am thankful to you both for these great gifts you have given me, and I'm thankful for your sharing your home with me and teaching me the unchanging laws of the Supreme Deity, and for making me aware of what I really am. You prepared me for the karmic burden which I have on earth. I have nothing to give you except my love. Thank you very much." We stood together for a few moments in silence. Irina said that many friends were gathering outside to see me off. I walked out our arched front door for the last time to see all these smiling faces. Rimji Zamora, Vonick, and many others whose names I have been lost in my consciousness now. We never really called each other by name. Not much was said out there on the lawn. Each of my friends gave me a special goodbye, where they pressed their hands slowly over their heart before clasping my hands and pressing them to their lips. Or they would lean over and kiss me softly on the third eye. I felt very sad. I hated to leave Rimji. This was not a goodbye, were his last words to me, but he would see me again. My aunt hugged me and said she loved me, that I should remember that her strength was always with me, and she had great faith in me. I would do okay on Earth, my uncle said, that I would not be doing well in the material way for a while, but that I would be doing well in a material way later in my life there. We all knew that for a time our lives would go in separate directions, but one day in eternity we would see each other again as soul. I saw in each of their glances so much love and real warmth that it shall fill me for the rest of my days, as long as I can close my eyes and visualize all this. I knew that whatever I suffer on earth is worth it if anyone else will be able to experience all these beautiful things. This I remember about my last day there on Venus. I stepped into the bubble car with my uncle, embracing my aunt for the last time, feeling her cold lips on my cheek. As I glanced into her beautiful sea-green eyes, my uncle will be joining me on the journey to the physical plane in order to be able to finish his scientific work. Another man who had brought the ship would also be joining us. As we sped up and away, I waved goodbye, looking down at their upturned faces and waving hands. One last time I saw our beautiful home among the flowers and trees. For a moment I wish I had not made the decision. I cupped both hands around my eyes to try and keep that view a few seconds longer. We sped over the mountains so familiar to me. Off in the distance I could see Titonia, the great temple of learning, which had been my home away from home. I could see the gold sand of the beach where I played and loved to sink my toes in the sparkling sea. I could always hear in the distance from our house. All of these things took in for the last time from the sky, as I had never seen and appreciated them before. As we entered the clouds, I pulled myself from the side of the ship, took a deep sigh, and realized all this was forever gone in this lifetime. I prepared myself for my new life and put my mind to thinking about these things and about what my uncle would be telling me. The ride to Sahasrara del Kanwal was swift, and it was near the mountain of light that we landed. I waited a while. My uncle proceeded to meet the master and receive permission for using the special zone. Only the spiritual travelers, their initiates, and those who are at least 1,000 years old on the astral plane have the privilege of meeting with this master. It is easy to understand how people who live such long lives in this city can believe they have reached the ultimate heaven. We are encouraged on foot to the special zone. I am not allowed to reveal its exact location. Few on earth know of the existence of such a zone, and it is better that it remain a secret. Almost anything can be brought down to the physical plane through this zone, such as gold and powerful inventions of the future. The greedy person could misuse this zone for his own purpose. This is the same zone through which a person travels upward after death of the physical body. Here, karmic debts are weighed, and the individual is then placed on the plane he has earned in a spiritual sense. Within this zone, we entered a special room, a round room, with blue lights so bright that I could barely see anything. All of us, my uncle, the other man, and I sat cross-legged on the floor and chanted a secret mantra. Mantras are words which are very powerful instruments on any plane because they have to do with the sound current, vibrations in parentheses, the basic fabric of all creation. On the astral plane, we normally chant to raise our vibrations for soul travel. Now we were doing just the opposite, lowering our vibrations to manifest a physical body. For a person who is totally at comfort living in the astral body, manifesting a physical body is a shocking experience. I had the same feeling of distress and discomfort that most people have in leaving the astral plane. The whole experience is not easy to explain. A few minutes after chanting the secret word with our eyes closed, it happened. The world seemed to cave in all at once. I remember a brilliant white flash and fireworks inside of me, a psst sound, and a ringing in my ears, and a curious jerking motion of my body as if all my muscles were tensed at once. All of this happened in the same single moment of shock. I felt dizzy and disoriented and could barely breathe, and my whole body felt uncomfortably warm. Then I realized that the shell enveloping me was the physical body. I opened my eyes. We were sitting in the grass near a small, shiny metallic cylinder vehicle that was shaped like one of your saucers upside down and had a dome on top. Off in the distance, miles away, was the city of Retz on the physical plane of Venus. It was frightening, this being inside of a physical body. I continued having trouble breathing because I had never done it before. And instead of the wide vision of my astral eyes, I was looking through two little holes, my new physical eyes. To help you understand how miserable I felt, imagine yourself suddenly being encased in a suit of armor, feeling restricted and clumsy, and knowing there's no way out. When I tried speaking for the first time, my voice sounded foreign to me. I told my uncle I didn't like it, this being in a physical body. He laughed. He said that I had to grow accustomed to it. How was I supposed to grow accustomed to something like this? I wondered aloud. Odin replied that a person can get used to anything. But you have to turn your head to see, I protested. I was not accustomed to turning my head in order to see because on the astral plane, we have an awareness of what is all around us. We also have an ability to change our form and appearance. Here, I was stuck in a body that was unchangeable except for the facial expression. My uncle agreed that it was limited, that I would have to learn to keep my balance and walk properly. Walking turned out to be most awkward. I was used to gliding or simply appearing wherever I wanted to be. But the physical body did not work that way. It had to be moved inch by inch, step by step. I was the only one having much trouble getting up and stretching my new legs. After all, I was, by physical standards, only a 7-year-old child. The Venusian physical, in parentheses, at this upper density, looks much like Earth's Nevada and Arizona. In the distance, I was able to see mountains and interesting vegetation. The weather seemed dry and hot, but not at all uncomfortable here. Retz was in a secluded valley here, just as on the astral plane. My uncle had explained a few days earlier during our journey through the astral plane that Retz is a city existing fully on two planes at once. The physical city is the spiritual of the physical planet. The astral city of Retz exists first, and the physical city is a duplicate. While in the Great Transition, the reverse happened. The people recreated cities on the astral plane as duplicates of the physical cities they had left. Retz is truly unique. It is unique not only in this respect. The city is covered by a climate protection dome of approximately 80 kilometers in diameter. Thus, it has already existed as early as the physical Venus, still looked very much like Earth's desert regions. Retz is hidden deep in a valley. As the region is covered by hot gases, only the city's geographical location and its climate protection dome allowed it to exist. The dome is not transparent, but made of disguising materials which make it appear like being a part of the dreary wasteland of the physical Venus. This is why Retz cannot be discovered by earthly spacecraft, even though it physically exists on Venus. My uncle and the other man and I tested our new limbs. I noticed that Odin had not changed in form, but his body was less radiant. In fact, everything around us lacked the wonderful quality of being luminous. I was not sure how I myself looked. I would not be seeing a mirror until I landed on Earth, but I surely did feel clumsy and heavy. With my first steps, I felt as if I was walking in a suit of lead. Before we walked toward the ship, my uncle told me about my special gift. My memento of Venus was to be a sample of the plants and flowers that grew nearby in this physical level of Venus. Together we collected about 24 of the most interesting ones and prepared them for transport to Earth. These, together with my ring and jewelry, were my only possessions. Taking me by the hand, Uncle Odin led me to the Venusian convoy, the saucer-shaped spacecraft. That was my first experience with the convoy at times seen in Earth's skies. On Venus alone, there are several models of the spaceship, all of which run in the same way. Advanced planets have their own versions, and there are many sizes and shapes. The ship I was about to enter looked very much like two saucers flipped together with the bottoms up. A raised glass dome on top housed a coil, and just below and all around were small portholes. The ship had three metallic hemispheres evenly spaced underneath. The outer surface of the ship was made of a specially treated titanium material so that it can withstand the friction and heat of atmospheric flight. Though it was very shiny and metallic looking, it was not like the titanium to be seen on Earth. It had the translucent quality of fiberglass. We entered through a circular opening in the lower half of the craft. This door really amazed me. My uncle showed me how it opened and closed. First, a tiny hole appeared in the surface where there was no sign of any door or opening, not even a seam. The opening grew larger and larger, much like the shutter of a camera, until it was large enough for a tall Venusian to walk through unimpeded. When it closed, the circular opening became smaller and smaller until it disappeared, leaving no trace of an opening, only a blank surface. My uncle tried to explain to me scientifically how it worked, but I didn't understand. It had something to do with the separation of molecules. Inside, he showed me where to sit. In the very center of the ship was a pole several feet in diameter, reaching from floor to the glass dome above. Surrounding it on the floor was a big lens through which I was able to see the ground during the flight. All around the lens, at intervals, were curved, cushioned benches for the passengers. Here I sat down with our companion pilot while my uncle took a seat at the control panel, which was opposite the wall where the entrance had appeared and disappeared. Uncle Odin started the ship. There was a low hum. I imagine my uncle had been trained to run this sort of ship before we left Etonia, as he seemed to know what he was doing. I was not very observant at the time because my attention was on my new body and how uncomfortable it felt. I do remember seeing all kind of glowing screens on the walls of the circular compartment with flashing colors, grid patterns, and wavy colored lines appearing and disappearing. The charts, Uncle Odin explained, help him guide the ship. They depicted the various atmospheric and magnetic conditions around planets and in space. The control panel looked very simple. My uncle sat in a swivel bucket seat facing a slanted panel with four buttons and a lever. Above the panel, there were two screens. One had what looked like a grid pattern of little squares covered with colored zigzag flashing lines. Each square was numbered with a different color. All the screens must have, in fact, been very important. One of the pilots was always watching them very carefully. Another screen facing the pilot showed the actual view of where the ship was heading. This screen was hooked up to a number of tiny lenses located around the rim of the ship. It was not until later that I was told how the ship worked. Uncle Odin explained that after we landed and went into Retz for a few minutes, we would be boarding and traveling in a larger mothership, which carried many of these smaller ships during deep space travel. The amazing thing about flying on board this craft is that there is not the slightest sensation of movement. In all my flights, I've never felt the slightest air turbulence or feeling of acceleration or of ascending or descending. When this ship makes a 90-degree turn at thousands of miles per hour, the passengers feel as if sitting in a room on the ground. The passenger must look out the portholes or through the viewing lens to see whether the ship is moving. Until I saw the ground receding below, I did not know we had taken off. The city of Retz passed below, and we landed on the opposite side, near the main gate. Spaceships are not allowed within the walls of the city. The three of us disembarked and went on foot toward the main gate. Although it was not easy, I did succeed in walking for a short while Uncle Odin held my hand. At times he carried me. We were on our way to the Temple of Golden Wisdom to receive the blessings of the Master, one of my favorites. Retz on the physical plane was almost identical to the astral city. I noticed this as we passed the gate and walked on. Having been there so often before, I had no desire to explore the city any further under these circumstances. I had little desire to do anything. Retz is heavenly by Earth standards, but compared to the astral city of Retz, its beauty is limited. The colors are not clear and bright, the buildings are not luminous, and the overall feeling is not the same. I could easily feel the much lower vibrations. The master was just as beautiful as ever. I must explain that a master can very well work with people on a number of different planes. This is one of the reasons he is called a master. At the temple, we spoke to him, and he gave us words of wisdom. I do not remember what he said, perhaps because the message was not for other people to hear. Aboard the ship once again, my uncle started it up with the familiar hum. Again, I would not have known we had taken off, but soon I could see Retz below getting smaller and smaller as we shot directly up. After a moment, we shot off at an angle through the upper atmosphere of Venus. The sky became darker as we continued on, for it had been close to dusk when we left Retz. There was little conversation on this trip. I was so busy looking at the features of Venus below us, I hardly noticed that my uncle and his companion exchanged places to do different things. Odin explained, as he sat next to me, that this ship was only used for short distances within a planet's atmosphere. Space travel would actually be on board a much larger cylinder-shaped spaceship that could hold up to 50 of these smaller craft. The mothership rarely landed, and it drew its energy from space itself, not elements mined on the planets. The smaller ships, called convoys, needed to be recharged regularly on the motherships. As I looked around, I saw this craft was very simple in design. In the center was the large cylinder cabin where we were sitting. Above was a storage compartment for supplies and repair parts. Though our technology is advanced, we do have breakdowns and we do need regular maintenance. We therefore carry special equipment for emergency landings. Using these small ships carry only, usually, these small ships carry only a few passengers, but in emergencies, a larger number can be safely carried aboard. There was also a walk-in room, much like a pantry, off to one side. This was the circular room containing fuses and wiring and flashing lights. Little children such as myself were not allowed to go in. I noticed in both of the pilots a sudden interest in the charts, that something important was about to happen. Then, through the viewing lens, I saw a huge dark shadowy mass below us and off to one side. The mothership. Dots of lights, the portholes of the ship were very well visible. Slowly, we floated closer and closer to the blunt nose of the long cylinder ship. Toward a slot of light, we descended until I felt a noticeable jar, the first in the flight aboard this vehicle. Odin explained that the rails of the mothership had caught the rim of our circular craft, upon which we will glide down to the spacecraft bay deep inside. All sensations of dropping ended, and the doors of the ship opened against a small platform with railings. Then I saw a beautiful woman whom I recognized as a Martian, and a man who looked Satarian, there to greet us as we stepped out of our ship. Two attendants attached cables to the ship as the platform elevator took us upward. At the entrance of a long passageway, we came to a stop, and our two companions took my hand and led the way. First, we came to the ship's lounge, a large, long room that was very simply decorated and could well seat over 100 people. Clusters of chairs, couches, and tables were arranged here and there. The color scheme was also very simple. One area had blue carpets and yellow furniture of muted colors, while the other end of the lounge had beige and earth tone colors. The room looked very pretty, very elegant. The lighting here, and in fact all over the ship, was the same strange lighting that we had on the ship. A soft, subtle light filled the air as if the air itself was giving off light. There were no light fixtures and no shadows. Along the walls of the lounge at intervals were perpetually running drinking fountains. I also noticed a portrait of a perfect balance between man and woman, simply called the deity, which I understand many ships have. I was told this being is called Elam. Elam for the physical plane. The drawings on the walls looked so much like photographs that I could not tell the difference. There were scenes of various planets, their cities, and a number of spaceships. The land and sea panoramas looked much like those which can be seen on Earth. So universal are nature's creations. There was hardly any clutter in the lounge, and not a single magazine or newspaper. A few sculptures sat here and there, but that was all. Beyond the lounge, we came to the ship's dining room. A long table sat with delicious-looking foods waited for us. All but a few seats had already been filled. At the head of the table sat the master of the ship, not the captain, but the spiritual master. Every Venusian space mothership, by custom, carries a master. On both sides of the table sat men and women in equal numbers. They were from various planets. Although the ship had been built on Venus, it belonged to no single planet. It was shared freely by all the members of the Brotherhood of Planets. I recognized people from Saturn, Mars, and Jupiter, in addition to Venus. The master, of course, in this case, was Venusian because this was a Venusian enterprise. No introductions were made as we seated ourselves at the table. Rather than using names, we all recognized each other's presence in silence. Our people usually do not even have names, but rather their own unique vibration. My own name and my uncle's were introduced later, after dinner. They called me Sheila, as I would be known on Earth. All the people said a blessing, then we ate in silence. Whenever a person had something important to say, we would stop eating and listen out of courtesy. Our dinner began with a salad of raw vegetables and a cheese preparation. As an appetizer, I was able to have a piece of my favorite fruit, yunya. We did not have meat. Instead, we had a slightly cooked vegetable topped with a melted cheese sauce. The bread was rather strange by Earth standards, dark brown, thin slices with a slightly sweet taste like pancakes. The water we drank was unlike what people of Earth are used to. It had a slightly heavier consistency, like thin oil, and was completely tasteless. Such water is common on our planet. All the water was delicious, even for our delicate new taste buds. After dinner, the master spoke to us and said that my trip to Earth was unique in the way it was being arranged, because I would be arriving as a child with my full conscious memory. One reason was karmic, but there was also another mission which would be revealed later. The master went on to say that later in my life, more light would be shed on my real reason for being on Earth and for coming in this way. My trip was special because I was not going only to fulfill my own personal karma. He concluded with this thought: later in life, people will admire her for her courage. The mothership was an interesting place. The crew always seemed to be busy. There were piloting, navigation, maintenance, and repair, food preparation, now that manifesting was being given up, supplies, control, and servicing of the shuttlecraft, not to mention the many scientific projects. I learned that two crew members worked each job for 2 days before being rotated to another job. This meant that everyone was able to work every job on the ship, from piloting and navigation to operating the cooking machines. At the end of every period, a general meeting of the ship's crew was held. I was able to watch two sessions, one on the first day after the special dinner, and another on the second day just before entering Earth's atmosphere. The trip to Earth lasted about 2 days. After dinner, I was fitted into a special spacewear, which looked very much like a ski suit. Then I watched and listened as the meeting was held. It was really more of an informal discussion where reports were given and new ideas were shared. Problems were always shared with all of the crew to help generate creative solutions. There were reports of the ship's progress and the latest developments and experiments that the scientists were constantly conducting. One of the main reasons for these ships roaming in space is for the sake of learning. A crew of scientists was always on board to study conditions in planets' atmospheres and analyze changes in and on the planets in space. Our people are attracted to space because we do not know everything. If the scientists learned something new, then this was shared with the rest of the crew, and every day the results of tests and experiments were made known, what had been learned and where the continuing problems were. I did not remember any of the specifics from the meeting because my interest only went so far. I had been given a present of an art kit, and I finished all the coloring with the help of two women crew members. That evening, my uncle mentioned the various things children on Earth can play with because they could not create their toys as on the astral plane. Coloring books and crayons were among them. This was similar, and I liked it, but was not allowed to take them along with me. My first experience with sleep came upon me unexpectedly. At first, I was not aware of the need for sleep because on the astral plane, there was more a resting of the mind. As long as my mind was alert, I did not need to rest my astral body. Since manifesting a physical body, my experience had been so new and strange that I never once thought of sleeping. I was in the lounge just sitting and listening to nearby conversations when all of a sudden I felt my head drop. Clunk. I jerked awake, frightened, not knowing what this all meant. My physical body's behaving very strangely, I thought. It kept happening over and over again until someone walked up to me. He explained that I had a physical body now, and if I did not take rest, then my body would do it on its own. Even if my mind was alert, he said, my body would fall asleep. That was the way it worked. The conscious mind would just completely go. With that, I went to sleep. Page 182. Next day, I had a tour of the mothership. First, I went to see where the small ships entered on rails and guided down to the hangar area below. Each time that the ship needs to be recharged, the man attaches clamps to the rim and pulls a lever. The red coils then glows for the entire recharging period. I was also shown the lower level at the opposite end of the ship where the saucers exited through another airlock. The mothership had three levels. The bottom level had the actual hangar area where up to 50 shuttles could be stored. The middle level contained the lounge, dining room, and the two pilot rooms. One pilot room was at each end of the ship. I did not get a look at these rooms because my interest was not there. My escorts explained that they were not much different from a shuttle's control area, only larger in scale and more specialized. The pilots' compartments also had a viewing lens set in the floor, much more powerful than those in the shuttles. Almost every room, especially the lounge, offered a clear view of space through the portholes. This is where I eventually had my first glimpse of Earth. The upper level of the mothership was divided into sleeping rooms and storage areas. Each of the rooms was like a motel room with beds that led out of the wall. In daytime, they were sitting rooms with desk and chair. Each room also had a fountain and washroom. Vonick had taught me about sleep, elimination, and the other functions of the physical body, but at that time I didn't understand the concepts, having no physical body in this lifetime. One of the women on board explained what the toilets were and how to use them. I had wondered aloud on that. Though each room could sleep two people, a crew member customarily had his own private room with a space view. Every two rooms shared a porthole. There were about 60 rooms in the mothership, but not all were occupied. Time passed quickly aboard the ship. It was toward the end of the second day that one of the crew members motioned for me to join him at the porthole. There was the Earth, a blue and white ball against the dark background of space. The blue areas, my friend explained, were oceans. The swirling clouds made strange but pretty patterns over the oceans, I thought. A part of the globe was dark, where night had not yet been transformed into day, so this was the planet where I would soon be living. The mothership entered only so far into Earth's atmosphere. Our convoy was to take us the rest of the way. At the hour of our departure, everyone gathered in the lounge to say goodbye. Some gave a hand clasp as a farewell, and others gave an embrace, depending on their own cultural backgrounds. My uncle and I and our companion pilot walked through the hallway and doors toward the spacecraft bay. Again, we stepped into the platform elevator as two protective railings swung into place around behind us. The same shuttle in which we had arrived was waiting for us. Odin took the controls, and I sat down around the viewing lens. In a moment, the door closed, and I could feel the ship gliding smoothly and silently down the rails to the airlock and hatch below. Then I saw the Earth getting larger and larger as we descended and approached the border between night and day. Soon after that, a giant range of mountains came into focus. My uncle pushed an inconspicuous button near the viewing lens. One lens slid away as another took its place. We no longer needed such great magnifying power. Our best lens is so powerful that the passengers aboard a craft like this can see people walking down the street while the ship is still so high that it is barely a speck in the sky. A protective cover slides over the lens to protect it from grime when the ship lands. And the last paragraph in this chapter. We skimmed the tops of those mountains and the lights of villages in the valleys below flitted past. The country where we were entering looked magnificently beautiful. As our ship approached the light side of Earth, I was awed by the huge mountains and lush green valleys. Our destination, my uncle said, was a spiritual city in the Himalayan mountains, known as Agamdes. Most of the space people Most of the space people arrive at Agamdes to grow accustomed to the lower vibrations of the planet Earth. And there you go.
Yeah, that was good.
Wow, that was amazing. My recorder looks kind of funny, but I hope it's okay.
I hope so, too.
I hope so, too. So, Omnic, thank you so much. Agamdes,
yeah, you're welcome. You did a magnificent job, Curtis.
Oh, thank you. I was...